Thanks. I'm going to continue this theme, but do it at a slightly less technical level, I think I'd say. I'm Suzanne Cashman. I'd like to acknowledge my colleagues and co-authors here. I'm based in central Massachusetts, and this is a project looking at trying to encourage physical activity among low-income people in central Massachusetts. We do not have the climate of California, and so we have other issues that we deal with. But the same issue comes out. Particularly low-income people have a real struggle being able to be physically active, and we find that over and over again. So there are a number of rationales about why we began this exercise program. The main one is this final bullet. There's a long history of a physician at one of our community health centers, Lucy Candip, who is the second author on this, has an experience with the YWCA as having been a user and a member of this particular facility, and this is really what got us going in this particular project. There's another piece, though, that's very important, and that is that the YWCA, have any of you involved with YWCAs in your communities anywhere? I had never been. I'm very impressed. Their mission is right out there on their business cards and on their windows, eliminating racism and empowering women. And they try to really stay true to that, those aspects of their mission. They do that in part through collaborative relationships with other community organizations. One of those had been the Community Health Center, where my colleague, Dr. Lucy Candip, had been working for many years and is still there through a breast cancer prevention program. And this particular YWCA offers something called institutional memberships, which means that an institution, a facility, an organization can purchase a membership for, in this case, it was $800, and for a year, up to three people from that institution or that facility could use the YWCA. So for us, it was patients at the Community Health Center, which is a federally qualified Community Health Center Section 330 site, which means it's low-income people that this particular health center sees as patients, could use the YWCA if the health center purchased this institutional membership. So Dr. Candip, who was tired of telling her patients, you need to exercise, knowing full well there was no way they were going to do that. They were low income, our weather for many months of the year is pretty lousy, maybe they don't have adequate footwear. Many of them are deconditioned, it doesn't feel good to exercise. So she took the proverbial bull by the horns and says, all right, let's get some institutional memberships. I'm tired of telling patients they need to exercise knowing they won't. Now I'm going to be able to tell them you need to get physical activity, and this is where you need to go in order to do it. So purchased these institutional memberships in 2004, and as you can see from these numbers, which is the title of this talk, if you build it, they will come. Yes, they did come. Many people had said, don't bother. Low-income people, particularly deconditioned people who have a lot of chronic illnesses, are not going to use the facility. Don't even bother spending your money. But there was such success in this particular program that after 2 years, the Y said, stop. We can't take any more patients of yours. Which posed a problem, because the reaction of the board and the reaction of the providers at the community health centers was, what's this message to our patients? Now the Y doesn't want them any longer. That's not a good message, and what are we going to tell our patients to do now? We can't send any new patients. So there was a lot of working on elements of that partnership so that it didn't crash. And that's another presentation and another series of comments, I think. We'll just let it go at this for now. So the Y was overwhelmed and said, hold it. Parenthetically, at the same time, we had been able to leverage this relationship with the YWCA with the YMCA. And the YMCA was beginning in Worcester, Massachusetts, was beginning to get a little more favorable about taking patients from the community health center and having them work out at that facility. So that was a parallel track, and it really helped in the nick of time, provide another avenue for providers for recommendations for patients. We took this work. It was never set up as a research project, which is some of the limitations and some of the problems. It was really set up as an intervention and a program, but we did get IRB approval and had a lot of sign-offs from the patients and HIPAA sign-offs so that they knew what was happening. And so we were able to backtrack it into a study which included this analysis of patient exercise activity, a subset of patients who had diabetes, looking at chart reviews for hemoglobin A1Cs, and then we did interviews with a subgroup of some of the exercisers to ask them, what do you like about exercising? Do you understand why you come here? Is it just because your provider said you need to do this, or were there other reasons too? So in doing this study, we were wanting to look at whether adult health center patients responded to this open access to exercise, and as you know from my comments just a moment ago, clearly they did. Whether those patients with diabetes who were participating could show measurable improvement as determined by hemoglobin A1C measures, and also to understand why some patients took up exercise and began to make it seemingly a part of their life. Some methods, we had the study cohort of adult patients 18 years of age and older who had made at least one visit. Admittedly, some went to the Y once and never returned. It was probably too intimidating, or they didn't want it, or they didn't like it, all kinds of reasons that could come into play there. The subset of the study of the diabetes sub-cohort, we looked at billing data and disease management registries, and then for the frequent users, we defined them as individuals who had made at least one visit a week for at least a period of 1.5 years from the time of their first visit, which would have occurred within this 4-year study period. We looked at demographic characteristics. We divided the cohort into usage groups. 24 visits, I can't say that's a whole lot over 4 years, but at least said they were using it. They didn't just turn and leave. And then subsequent categorical groups after that. Our outcome measures include number of patients going to the Y, demographic characteristics, usage frequency, the proportion of users with diabetes, and the change in these hemoglobin A1C values. This pie chart shows you the visits for year 2004. This project started in April, so that wasn't a full year. You see that the take-up is pretty rapid. In 2005, there are 33,000, the 3,000, no, it's one-third, sorry, one-third of the visits. In 2006, slightly larger, but still about a third. 2007 begins to be truncated, and 2006, at the middle of 2000, towards the end of 2006, is when the Y said, time out, we can't take any more new patients. And so subsequently, you see the number of visits in those subsequent years declining. These are the visits by quarter, by diabetes confirmed, diabetes not confirmed. There's a lot of problems going back over the chart reviews and looking to see it looks like they have diabetes, but there isn't the specific diagnosis diabetes in the chart. But those numbers are very small. The green bar is the more important one, I think, to look at is all diabetics, and then the purple is non-diabetics, and the blue is all diabetics, and these are done by quarter. And as you can see, in May of 06, when new enrollment stopped, the numbers go down precipitously. These are visits. Overall, these results by demographics, we had a little more than 1,000 exercisers, adult exercisers. This is in comparison to the number of adult patients at the health center is 14,000, so it's a pretty good proportion. And they produced over 4 years almost 24,000 visits. It's a lot of use of this particular YWCA, which is not set up, as I think of, as many YMCAs are, which means they got a lot of exercise equipment. This particular Y had something like 12 cardiovascular machines. It's very modest. We had almost 120 exercisers with diabetes. These are proportion women seem to be using this facility more, but there's a higher proportion of women who are patients at the community health center, roughly similar there, about almost two-thirds. The age of adults at first visit for all exercisers, you can see it's about 39 years old. Those with diabetes, it's older, almost by 10 years. So the patients with diabetes are coming, they tend to be older. Race and ethnicity, all exercisers, it's about 70% were Black or Hispanic. Exercisers with diabetes, about the same, but the adult population at Family Health Center, this particular community health center, is about 55, 56, 57% Black or Hispanic, so it's a higher proportion of exercisers, patients, adult patients using the facility were Black or Hispanic. Here on the right, you can see exercisers with diabetes, these 119, they tended to use the facility more often as determined by median number of visits. And you can see as the number of visits is broken down, this is the bottom half of the particular slide, the median visits are though roughly about the same as those exercisers broken down by number of visits who did not have diabetes. Hemoglobin A1C values, however, and this is where not having set it up as a research project is a problem. These values are the best we could get from the charts. The one most recent in the chart to an adult patient beginning to exercise, and then the one most recent to the end of this four-year period of study data. But what seems quite remarkable to us, and there's more work to do here, I think, to understand it better, is those patients who with diabetes who went fairly more frequently than those who didn't had noticeable changes in their hemoglobin A1Cs. And for those of you in clinical care, you'll know that these are clinically significant and make a difference. Of course, what matters in any of this work with people taking up exercise or trying to lose weight is how long they continue it, how long, how sustainable is it. But the overall observation is we had, as I had said earlier, about 1,000 patients moving into action phase. Patients with diabetes exercising more frequently had significant changes in hemoglobin A1C changes. There were a number of spin-off interventions, which really has been an unexpected positive consequence is that other projects have developed. We had a small project with Latino Trainer, with Latino exercise small groups, Fit Fun Fridays for families. The Y opens for free on Friday evenings, where anyone with a child can come in and use the facility for free. And then we were able to, as I mentioned, move to develop a relationship with the YMCA, and the YMCA, it's easier to have adolescents go there. They don't need parental permission as young as the age of 13. At the YWCA, they did. We also have, as a spinoff from this work, developed a creation for Latino Healthy Weight, which is a coalition there. I'm going to skip this these just to mention that the results from the sub-cohort of users. One of our medical students took it upon herself during the summer in between her first and second year of medical school to work with us to do interviews, really hard to do. These are some of the questions. Why were you referred? Do you know why you were referred? What's the most important reason you've continued to go? How do you think use of the YWCA has affected you? Have you noticed any changes, either physical or emotional? As I started to say just a moment ago, one of the things that made it really hard was tracking people down. There were 37 patients who'd averaged the requisite number of visits that we felt per week that needed to happen in order to be eligible for this process, and she was only able to reach 17 of them. If you look at the age, they tended to be a little older than the patients overall who were using the YWCA. There were a higher number of males, a higher proportion of males. I'm not sure what that says, but she was able to identify a higher proportion of males that were available to answer her questions and respond to them. Reasons for referral, as they understood it, tended to be, and all of these tables that I'm going to show you can add up to more than 17 because people could respond more than one reason for a response to the question. Many of them, BMI was too high, interest in staying in shape and preventing health problems. The reasons patients go, 11 of the 17 said they wanted to lose weight, build muscle. Remember, a lot of these are men. They wanted to maintain health and feel better, and then so on. It does get down, fewer of them were talking about specific diagnoses that they were trying to get in control, but they did appear as well. Reasons they continue, again, is to lose weight and maintain their health. Reasons to continue tended to spread out a little bit more, and you see socialization comes in here down at the bottom, but that's only 3 of the 17. Our hypothesis is that socialization can really help people continue to carry out exercise and keep with a regimen. They felt, many of them, that they had lost weight and gotten in shape. They were feeling better. Many of these responses track the earlier ones and are pretty consistent with the variations as with the number of people who were responding. So for summary, among the most common positive influencing factors toward exercise among these respondents was losing weight, self-esteem. They were adhering to clinicians' instructions. So overall, in conclusion, low-income patients, yes, they will actively use open access to exercise. And these other conclusions I think I've mentioned already. Just want to point out that we think the model is easily reproducible in other settings, and I hope one of the things that you'll take home with you is if you're trying to find partners to help encourage people to work out and exercise, that you'll look to your local YWCA or your local YMCA, but note that low-income people will take it up and this offer, and that these fitness centers can get overwhelmed if it's too much too soon. Clinicians might promote exercise adherence by emphasizing not just improvement into health, but self-esteem. Limitations, I'd mentioned several earlier throughout my earlier comments, but these are some additional ones, and I think the list could be a little longer if I had wanted to make it longer. I just mentioned briefly this YMCA initiative that we're very excited about because patients are using the YMCA now in great numbers. We haven't been able to analyze the data yet. We're still cleaning them, but maybe next year have them. The one difference which may be significant with the YMCA is they've said that after 1 month of free open access, then an adult needs to pay $10 a month to continue using it, which is a very low rate based on what they charge for a full membership, but it's a lot if you have no money. So we're going to be looking at the upshot of that and what's the result of charging $10 a month. So we hope others will replicate by connecting to their local organizations or other youth and adult organizations that have fitness facilities, including schools, and look to see whether those institutions and facilities that are often unused at various times when people might be able to use them could be opened in order to have them be available as well. So, thank you.
Thank you to all the presenters, very interesting topics. For Suzanne, the Y, in 2006 when the Y put a hold on it, a drastic drop in participation. Were the current enrollees able to stay enrolled?
Yes.
And if so, how does that speak to the sustainability of current enrollees continuing to go versus new enrollees just having the burst at the beginning, just like us?
Right. I think there are a few things. One is I think we had a number of open house sessions to explain to people what was happening because there were also some limitations on when they could use certain of the facilities, trying to make sure that at any one time there wouldn't be more than 6 patients using the workout room. at the same time. What had happened is they have 12 cardiovascular machines, and they were beginning to lose a few full pay members. So in part, and I understand that I'm based at the medical school, so I'm sort of in between. I understand the health center saying, oh my God, they can't do this, they can't do this. But I also understand the why saying, my gosh, we're losing our members. We can't let that happen. So they not only said no patients coming de novo, but there can't be more than six at any one time in the cardiovascular area. So we're trying to make sure that patients understood the reason for this. As we all know, none of us want to go to the why and figure we're going to work out and find, oh no, there are already six patients using the machines. I got to sit here in the lobby and wait until one of them leaves. And I have no idea whether they're just taking a long shower and talking to their friends or really working on that workout machine. So that was a problem. It appears to us that patients who had begun to really use the facility before this cutoff point in 06 did continue to use it. The message to them was not, we don't want you either. And the message never should have been, we don't want you. The message we always tried to make sure of was, we can't handle the numbers. And the providers at the health center immediately started referring people to the YMCA, which for the first year of referring to them, they had not instituted that $10 monthly fee. So it was open access to the YMCA as well, which is it's huge. Lots of machines. Build muscles.
What about like equipment like shoes and clothes and washing clothes? I always wonder if that's an expense and how you guys handle that or whether you
It is, that's a good question. And I know Lucy, my colleague, Dr. Kandup, has talked about trying to get, she's all about, if I know my patient needs to do something and my patient can't, it's my responsibility to at least try to, yeah.
Do you know how she handled that?
No, I think she tried to get donations of sneakers, workout shoes for some of her patients as she was able to. I haven't heard her talk about that recently, however, so I'm not sure. I'm going to ask her when I see her next. I'm not sure where that stands, but I know she had talked about that as being an issue that some of her particular diabetic patients, she said, you need to change your foot gear. You can't wear the same set of sneakers all the time, and they, you know, I haven't got any other set of sneakers. Yeah, good question. Thank you.
I was wondering about the emphasis with the diabetic patients that were being referred. Did the Y offer some kind of diabetic, you know, some education, other activities that be involved with? I mean, they had breast cancer screening on there.
Yeah, that's a great question. Well. So the breast cancer screening, I think, fits into the YWCA's empowerment of women and around mammography screening and working. They worked in concert with the Family Health Center to help get the message out to residents that there's a mobile van or use the community health center. I don't think they did anything in particular about diabetes. They do have trained trained exercise instructors. And they may be trained in not just how to use this machine, but some of the other things I didn't say is each of these patients had to get clearance from a provider, a physician or a nurse practitioner. And the clearance information was faxed over to the Y, and then that clearance information was used by one of the staff members at the Y to help introduce the patient to the machines. And the machines are intimidating if you've never worked out on them too and don't know how to use them. And if your primary language is Spanish and most people speak English, you know, it can be very off-putting, I think. So the clearance would have said, this patient has diabetes, but it wouldn't necessarily have said, trainer, please make sure the patient does such and such because of the diabetes. Does that answer your question?
More or less. I think the 17 interviews, was a small one. That was a good reinforcement. My question for the other two presenters was more on the basis of this ethnic difference between physical activity and sports participation. And I don't know if it's in maybe in lower income areas or differences between different groups that maybe put more of an emphasis on, you know, competitive sports versus just being active. You know, some of our other, one of our earlier seminars was getting people who are not in competitive sports to participate. I just wondered what other kind of research could be done into these subgroups to figure out what their influences are on getting into competitive sports, parental.
I think from our perspective, from our studies, it had to do with your socioeconomics in terms of, especially for poor Latinos, immigrants in Southern California, at least in San Diego, is that I'm sure they want to take their kids to sport leagues and all that because that's part of the, you know, being in the United States, but they don't have the money. Those are very expensive, and that's part of why we've been doing some of the interventions too in terms of, for example, I know that some of the interventions that we have done in the center is to partner with Nike, and they have a big presence in the area, and they are actually donating and have programs to donate equipment, footwear, and so on for kids and in adults, and supporting some redevelopment of the parks. So we started from the ground up in terms of actually rehabilitating the parks in their neighborhood so they can actually go and play, or trying to be soccer leagues and so on. So I think it's a function of socioeconomics and the characteristics of the neighborhood that may have an influence on that in terms of, and then a process of acculturation in terms of learning that, you know, soccer leagues or, you know, organized sports are part of the things that you do here in the United States, and instead of just playing on the street, which they cannot do no longer. So I don't know if that answers your question.
But it's even having the resources to do the informal pickup games.
Exactly. So, and then the parents work two or three jobs sometimes, and they come home late, and the kids don't have somebody who can actually help them to do, you know, to organize so they can go and play. So there's a lot of factors involved in not having them to, you know, be part of those activities. So boys are more active, I guess, naturally, and then we need to explain why than girls in this case. So.
Yeah, I think actually maybe another thing that would determine sports participation among different racial ethnic groups might have to do with access to not just, you know, park facilities that can host teams and sporting events, but also just the density, because a lot of Latino and African-American neighborhoods are much more dense than white neighborhoods. So you would think that, the number of spots available for sports teams, and then exactly access to transportation just to get to and from, you know, a lot of these neighborhoods are also the unsafe neighborhoods. So it might not be feasible for them to ride bikes or walk, you know, depending on where they would be, you know, doing sports.
I also wonder whether there's anything to do with the champions. This is my stereotype here, that the boys, Latino boys, are they more likely to have champion figures in their home country, or at least Spanish-speaking figures who are big athletes, soccer players? Are there those comparable champions who are women in their?
No.
I can answer that. No.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there are, but maybe that's my
limitation. We don't have. So we have nieces and, you know, they're like fashion girls in the novella. So no, we don't have those role models.
So I wonder if the boys, it also is.
But they're born here in the United States, and I think your data speaks to that in terms of their first and second generation kids. So it is different. So they're navigating these two cultures and trying to mediate that between, like, okay, this is what my friends in school are doing, but my parents cannot afford helping me to do that. Right. So that's it.
Yeah, and this was sort of a question for both of you too. And that whole issue that you found, Brent, with the kids in the higher income Latino households having less sports activity.
Higher education.
And so I'm wondering if that also has to do with residential housing patterns, because as they become more middle class, they tend to move to the suburbs and they drive more, and, you know, they actually oftentimes have less time to take their kids to soccer or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could look at some of the just data around residential housing patterns, because I think that is a problem.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Yeah, yeah, and there could also be stigma attached with being Latino in a white neighborhood.
Right. And also, having sent kids to high school in California, girls in particular, you know, it was obviously noticeable that as the girls get into high school, there was a huge discouragement of sports activity among minority youth.
Discouragement from parents, teachers?
No, it was just culturally, girls were not encouraged to be in the sports teams like we were when we were growing up. Okay, it's just a different cultural context.
And I would add to your comment, you know, I wrote it down because I thought it was a very interesting result in terms of generational status. Because
yeah.
It might be that these kids are, or these parents are first or second generation. So they were educated here in the United States, and you need to account also for acculturation. So they speak English, for example, in the home. I would think that might have something to do with that association in terms of, you know, finding the lower levels of physical activity. Because what we know is that the more acculturated first and second generation Latinos in the United States eat less healthy, right? So the trends of, they come here and they eat more fruits and vegetables and less fat, or more fat, but then as they become acculturated and the second generation eat worse than their predecessors. So I wonder if that also, I wouldn't know exactly for physical activity, but I wonder if that's the same trend that you can see there.
No, it's actually the opposite.
The opposite,
but I did account for immigrant generation in the model.
You did?
Yeah, so it's net, it's actually net of income effects and net of immigrant generation effects.
Okay.
Which is, you know, one of the reasons why it's so mind-blowing to me.
Yep. You've got another study.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Any other comments?
I have a question for the last speaker. Do you know of any other really good examples of a program like that? I've been pushing for that on the really high federal level with Medicaid to provide free access to the lowest income population, to YMCAs and other group dance, martial arts, yoga classes in the private sector too, and just paying on a per use basis kind of thing as sort of exercise medicine and prevention. But there aren't that, it's not that easy to find models like this, examples.
I've started to see in the literature, and I didn't do any literature review here because I figured it would have been done over and over and over again in this conference because this topic is so hot now. But I have seen a few studies looking at providing access to low-income people to a YWCA or a YMCA. But I haven't seen any that are founded on this kind of partnership that really required a lot of work. I just take a minute. I think the YWCA could easily have walked away from this partnership. What were they getting for it? Yes, it helps them meet their mission, but there are other ways they could do that. They lost some of their front staff because the staff didn't want, the receptionist staff didn't want to deal with those people. These were not the upper class business people coming in at lunchtime. These were low-income people who maybe didn't have the etiquette, admittedly. We maybe didn't do enough work on our side to teach them the etiquette of using a facility like this. But the YWCA, the leadership, was absolutely clear. They were continuing with this. They hired several front staff who were bilingual to make sure that people were more welcomed. And the leader, the director of the Y said, hey, if we lose some members and we lose some staff, that's okay. She didn't back away.
But what were the other examples? Do you remember them?
Do you have a card?
I want your card.
All right. We'll do it.